Hi, Matt. It's a pleasure to join you again today. I'm Darren Campbell, CEO of Namibia Critical Metals. We are developing the Loftal Heavy Rare Earth Project in Namibia. We are fully permitted with a 25-year mining license. One of the largest deposits of the heavy rare earths, dysprosium and terbium, anywhere in the world outside of China. And we are development funded through our joint venture agreement with the Japanese government agency, JODLI.
Hi, my name's Todd Ross, and I'm the Managing Director of Nordic Nickel, ASX-listed nickel exploration company. We're focused on our assets in the Central Lapland Greenstone Belt of northern Finland, where we have a flagship project called the Pulu Project that already has a contained resource of 862,000 tonnes of contained nickel. And that's just on 5 square kilometres of our 240 square kilometre land package. So our focus is on targeting the OEMs and the demand coming from nickel supply in Europe.
Hey everyone, I'm Greg Beischer. I'm CEO of Alaska Energy Metals. And as the name implies, our project is in Alaska, USA. We've got a very large deposit of nickel with accessory copper, cobalt, and platinum group elements.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us today. We're gonna talk to you about some of the things you've got in common, some of the thinking that you've done before starting your respective companies, and perhaps what investors should be looking at, thinking about, and understanding before they deploy their capital. So, Darren, I'm going to start with you. And Namibia Critical Minerals in Namibia. Rare earths. Now, that had quite a good run up until last year when it kind of came, the shine came off somewhat. So just talk to me about the thesis for why we need more rare earths.
There's no question that the pricing for rare earths has been decimated over the last 18 months for a number of reasons, largely supply-demand, I think. The electrification of the worldwide fleet hasn't quite taken off at the frenzied pace that was maybe expected a few years ago. But we're very bullish on the medium and long-term outlook for rare earths, particularly heavy rare earths for dysprosium and terbium, which are two of the highest value of all rare earths. And they are critical components used for production of permanent magnets. So, and we have one of the largest deposits outside of China of those two heavy rare earths. About 5,500 tons of contained dysprosium and about 800 tons of terbium.
Right, so you've got to believe that the rare earth market will pick up again as the OEM market picks up again. It wasn't a bad year, 35% increase in sales. And I think Todd and Greg, you're probably going to have a similar story in terms of potentially the alignment with the OEM activity. So why didn't nickel do its thing last year?
Darren, from our perspective in the U.S., I feel that the United States is very vulnerable at this point. It's essentially abdicated metal supply chains all over the world and could get cut off, particularly on rare earth elements, but also nickel. United States imports 100% of the new nickel that it consumes. Thankfully, there's some friendly countries like Canada and maybe Finland that export to the United States, but the country's vulnerable. And so we've got to develop resources closer to home, preferably right on American soil, but at least in free trade countries.
Right. And Todd, obviously for you in Europe, it must be a pretty similar story, but how is the kind of China, Indonesia, Philippines triumvirate affecting business over there in Europe?
Yeah, well, look, it's clearly had an impact with the nickel price in the last 12 months or so. But I think, you know, for us, we still remain very, very bullish on the outlook, given, the demand that's coming. The fact that, as Greg just mentioned, you know, that countries are looking to secure supply outside of China, in particular in Europe, they're looking to secure supply that's sustainably sourced and traceable. We've obviously seen the challenges that came from the invasion from Russia into Ukraine, and that really gave everyone a real wake-up call around securing raw materials in general. But, you know, obviously the EV transition or the energy transition was well and truly underway before that already. And now they've realised that being able to secure critical minerals is a very big component of what needs to happen in Europe at the moment.
Okay, and talking of commonalities, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you're all affected by what China does. If it catches a cold, there's a real problem. No place more evident than in rare earths, where most of the expertise sits. So what is the West going to do to rid itself of that problem? And, you know, how's your company approaching things? Darren?
Well, the Western economies and governments have woken up to that risk. Just recently, a week or so ago, there was the official rollout of the Mineral Security Partnership between the U.S. and the EU. Namibia actually also joined on to that organization as well. So you're starting to see some tangible movement now on governments getting more involved in funding of critical metals projects all over the world. The U.S. Department of Defense has been writing some big checks for some projects to expand rare earth mining and processing capacity in the U.S. Australia has been very, very much in the news recently. They announced an $800 million loan to the Arafura project to process and refine rare earths. Japan also has been very active in upstream exploration and development for a decade. You know, JOGMEC and Sojitz have funded Lynas, which is the largest rare earth company in the world in Australia. They've funded them over $300 million to date. So Western governments are starting to get more active because they realize they have to diversify that supply chain.
Right. And just sticking with you, Darren, on this one, clearly the issue in the past, certainly when from my banking days, you know, rare earths had this kind of very erratic behavior in terms of pricing. It's still a relatively nascent industry. And as you suggest, you know, governments are only just kind of catching on to the fact that they need to probably invest downstream and upstream to kind of stabilize things. So what do you think is going to normalize this price volatility going forward for rare earths?
Well, I think as the demand continues to peak over the next decade on EVs becoming more prevalent, not just EVs, there's other industries that are going to be demanding a lot of permanent magnets, wind turbines come to mind. So I think that the lid that's being kept on the pricing, maybe somewhat artificially over the last year and a half, can only hold for so long as, China, I think, is really more interested in keeping prices low for their own domestic supply and not necessarily worried about supplying the rest of the world at the stage. So there's going to be you're going to need more supply coming on stream to fill that gap.
Yeah, I think things are very similar in the nickel situation. You know, China working in Indonesia's developed, ramped up its production to meet the demand and even beyond to try to control the pricing of the metal. But the projected demand is going to outstrip that supply in the coming years, and the price will go back up. So I think it's a very similar situation with the rare earths.
I definitely think it is. I mean, Todd,
sorry, Matt. It comes to the point of the governments have set some pretty hefty targets globally around the energy transition and trying to reduce carbon emissions. What do we all want to do about it? In terms of how are we going to find the raw materials that we need to be able to actually allow that energy transition to take place? And do we all want to be buying from one particular country, or do we want to secure supply outside of reliance on just China? So I think that's where we're going to start to see some shifts happening. There's a lot of structural shifts happening in the whole market at the moment, but certainly in the nickel space, I think beyond what's going on at the moment, we're going to need all of that nickel coming out of Indonesia, all of the new sulfide projects in the world, and a lot more that still haven't even been discovered to be able to satisfy that demand that's coming.
Greg, can I talk to you about what the US government's... They're very powerful. They've got a lot of buying power. They can affect change very, very quickly. Will they go upstream, or are they more likely, as they have done with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act budget, is mostly downstream into industry, who seem to be the main beneficiaries at the moment? Because I'm told time and time again by exploration CEOs that the market is broken. How can the U.S. government help you?
Yeah, well, they're helping in terms of actually making grants, even to some fairly early stage exploration projects, which is, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. That's great. There does seem in the U.S. to be still a disconnect. I mean, it's full hard on go, 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 electrify, electrify, but not at the same time adjusting, streamlining the mine permitting system and encouraging domestic mine development to the extent, in my view, that they should be.
Right. And Todd, I'm going to come back to you, just sticking with nickel for a second, if I might. It's not a very competitive landscape at the moment for nickel. We kind of need all the nickel we can get. And we need that price incentivization to fit into place. But that's very difficult when you've got this narrative in the market about Indonesia being able to supply, being the OPEC of nickel, being able to supply all of the world's needs. Now, clearly, with the China factor in there, that makes conversations difficult, and it makes it difficult for CEOs to make decisions. So how do you read that? What do you do about it?
Yeah, look, I think it's a massive challenge. You know, we're predominantly funded by retail investors, you know, and capital markets on the ASX, you know, and we're all competing for that same pool of risk capital. Yeah, so we're essentially all competing for the same pool of risk capital to try and fund the development and discovery of new nickel projects globally, but without having some alternative sources of funding to be able to actually advance those exploration opportunities, it's very, very difficult to raise money in the market for a nickel exploration company at the moment. So while we've got government funding coming, we've got incentives and grants that might be coming more on the downstream, certainly on the EU side, at least it's predominantly more focused on the downstream. It's very difficult to really advance exploration projects in on the nickel side.
Okay, and so Darren, I'm going to jump to you with regards to how you've got so much in common, right? You're all explorers. There's the kind of China factor here. There's the access to capital, you know, broken market here. You're having to think of different and more creative ways to actually fund projects through all the phases that they need to go through. But the one thing which does drive this, and I think gold is seeing that in the last, since PDAC, I think, this recovery for gold is going to change the fortunes of many companies, I suspect. It may even bump start the equity sector for mining. Is price incentive for rare earths is going to be important. And as we mentioned, this very erratic behavior up until now, do you see some sort of leveling of rare earth pricing going forward? Is that going to help you? You know, how do you change your narrative as a result?
Well, I think we've hit the floor for rare earth pricing over the last 6-8 months. I think they're unsustainable for a long period of time at these prices, and the demand curve is such that it's going to force the prices to come up in the short term, I believe. But back to your other question, just on government funding for exploration, just wanted to add a point. I think it's tough. It's a tough sell for governments to invest money directly into exploration phase companies. It's tough politically for them to sell, I think. I think it's maybe more appropriate for them to go about it another way. Similar like in Canada, we have flow-through share tax incentive programs for investors to essentially get a full write-off of their investment right at the get-go for projects that are only in Canada. The governments could look at a similar strategy to what Japan does. We formed a strategic partnership with JOGMEC, the Japan Organization for Metals and Energy Security. They have a massive budget in excess of $10 billion U.S. a year, and their mandate is to secure supply of natural resources for Japanese industry. So they are very active in funding early-stage exploration projects all over the world to de-risk them, to then bring them to Japanese industrial companies, to then invest and take them to market and get them into production. That could be a very a good model for the West, for other Western countries to adopt.
I mean, and it's early days, Greg, but nevertheless, you must have one eye to the future and a constant eye on, you know, anti-dilutory behavior. Do you see the market price incentive being there for nickel for your project, or do you need to start thinking earlier about, as Darren's just outlined, strategic partnerships, sharing of balance sheet, or the power of balance sheets of bigger players? I mean, how do you fight your way through this?
Well, yes, in our particular case, since we have such a large resource, it's really a resource that's suitable for only the largest mining companies in the world, and so we definitely have an eye to bringing in strategic investors now that we've established this resource. And that's fine if they're mining companies, but we also look to potential offtake buyers as well. So, you know, we've seen, for example, Samsung come in as a strategic partner to Canada Nickel, which has a very similar bulk tonnage deposit in Canada. Samsung's building battery plants in the United States, and they definitely need that nickel supply to have the raw materials for their plants. So yeah, we definitely look to strategics as a source of capital for our project.
Right, but how early do you start, I guess, is the question, because it's kind of like the normal rules don't apply for the last 3 years, and I'm just wondering, does that change the dynamic? Does it change the way that people advance projects? You can't keep repeating the same stuff and hope for success, it seems, anymore. So do you start that process much earlier than perhaps you typically would have done?
Perhaps that's true. I mean, for our company, it's a new company, but for a long time, we operated on a joint venture model. So we're very accustomed to bringing majors in early on projects. And I believe in it. Yeah, establish those relationships early and bring them as strategic partners to help them with the heavy lifting too. And they have expertise that may not exist within our company.
And have those typically been sort of like non-dilutory? They don't come in at pubco level. They come in at asset level. Is that how it works?
You know, it's not unreasonable to ask a premium on the share price in an equity financing because they're gaining a foothold into us.
And Todd, if I can, what about you? You know, you're an Aussie company with a European asset. It gets complicated, and then you've got to look at the market as well. So you're juggling a few balls in the air there, right?
Yeah, and we've certainly been very much looking at the strategic partnerships angle from the outset. I mean, we're a relatively new company as well. Yeah, just over 2 years, or almost 2 years since we listed. But, you know, we recognized earlier on that, you know, the project's quite large anyway, and it's going to need some partnerships with, you know, larger mining houses who are going to support us to explore it. But we've kind of run multiple avenues that we're focused on with strategic partnerships, mining houses, but also then with the OEMs, you know, who are obviously looking to try and get access to material. You know, if there's only two nickel mines in the whole of Europe and we're hoping to one day be the third, they realize that, you know, unless they can get an offtake with the existing mines, which are already all locked up, they need to come further down the chain to look at earlier stage projects. And they might be, you know, just, you might have to give away some future rights of offtake, but at least they provide some capital injection earlier on to allow you to advance the project a bit further. So we need to sort of work on all angles.
Okay, and Todd, just sticking with you on that one, and we've recently been sort of engaged with a kind of group with, talking about sort of social license. That's like one of the First Nations groups was, you know, has written a letter about their concerns over exploration activities. And that causes a little bit of doubt in the minds of investors and the market when things like that happen. And you know, operating where you are, what are the issues that you have to deal with on the social side?
Yeah, look, you know, we're no orphan there. We have to obviously always make sure that we've got good partnerships and relationships with the local community, local landholders, you know, local land users as well. So that was always going to be first and foremost what we focused on. We appointed a sustainability manager last year who's a Finnish guy, lives in that part of the world. But, you know, we don't want to be doing anything that's going to be ending up making the world a worse place than where we first started. So, you know, obviously no one likes a big open pit mine or, you know, a mine in their backyard. But where we're operating is in a mining jurisdiction. There's already two very large mines operating nearby to us. And so we recognised that earlier. We worked with the local community, the local mayor, stakeholders in our project area. So we've made sure that we're trying to address that all early on. It's critical. You know, if we don't get that right, there's no point in trying to advance it at all. You're never going to get the support.
What about Namibia? I mean, it's a big country. You know, whatever the population is, like less than 3 million or something. So it's quite relatively small. Do you have issues? Do you face issues in terms of doing what you want to do? Does that sort of have knock-on effects with regards to how long it takes to get licenses and permits in place, Darren?
You can have problems if you don't go about it the right way, just like in any jurisdiction. We've had a fantastic experience working in Namibia. It's one of the best jurisdictions in all of Africa, if not the best, in my opinion. We've been operating there for about 12 years. We've established a fantastic relationship with the local community in which we work. We've been very transparent. And just as important as getting a mining license, getting that social license is just as important. And I think I'm very proud of the work that we've done over the last 10 years in that. And actually, we just recently were elected as a CSR best practice by the Namibian Association of Community Resource Development in the country. So, and that's because of, you know, we've done a lot of work in the community. We've sponsored local schools in our area, provided water wells for local farmers, and have been completely transparent with the community on our project as we move forward through environmental assessments and the plans. So we're really proud of that work. So it's a lot of work and effort that you have to undertake right from the get-go of a project if you really want to be successful.
So we're all in violent agreement. You need to do it. You absolutely should do it. But Greg, I still look down at South America and look at some of the issues down there in terms of some of the mines, well, the headlines last year about problems caused by not having the right social license. Canada and the US has always been put forward as, you know, Fraser Institute ranked number one place to do business if you're in the mining sector. I mean, is it still that, or is it you just got to still watch your P's and your Q's, Greg?
Well, it's a great jurisdiction. If we're talking about Alaska, for sure, it should rank very highly on a global scale as a destination for mineral investment. You know, I could go through the checklist, starting with native land claims, which have long been resolved here in Alaska for over 50 years, in fact, and a fantastic model in which 12 corporations, native-owned corporations, were formed, and how 50 years later are spectacularly successful, each of them measuring their net worth in billions of dollars, and managed by educated, sophisticated native business people. the land in Alaska is owned either by the federal government, state, or native people. But the demarcation is very clear. There's no overlapping land claim or anything like that. And so if you want to explore on native-owned land, it's a business contract between two American businesses. So there's a lot of clarity here in Alaska in that regard. State-owned land is a very good place to explore. The state has a very efficient mine permitting system, but always the federal government's involved, and they don't operate at the same time scale as does the state. There's no really sideboards on response times, and that, to me, is the biggest problem with permitting mines in Alaska. We don't want the regulations relaxed in any way. We just want time frames for response. We've made our application. We've made our case. We'd like to get a decision more quickly.
Right. And so we're looking at some of the kind of social component here. I'm interested because, again, the commonality that all of you have, that you're all of a certain size and you face the same challenges, irrespective of the jurisdictions. And I'm just wondering what they are and how you handle them. You know, things like water usage or biodiversity impact. And obviously, we talked about some of the social components there. How do you view the kind of cost that's being loaded onto you guys? In terms of having to do more reporting, more documentation around some of these factors, and what does that do for your business? I mean, Greg, I'll stick with you. I mean, how are you seeing all of that?
No, I don't view it as a high cost. It's just how to do business right. As the things Darren was describing are spot on. You embed yourself in the community early, become a part of the community. And from our standpoint, our geologists are the first ambassadors in the field, the first ones to interact with the community. And we make sure they truly understand to be respectful, be cognizant of the idea that some of the community may be skeptical, may be wary of the potential of mine development. But like Darren said, transparency and full communication is the key, and engage that community early.
Yeah, look, it's super critical. I mean, unless you can do that, like I said, there's no point being there because you're never going to be able to advance it anyway, really. And it's all part of doing business in the jurisdictions. And, you know, obviously I'm an Australian, but, you know, why am I in Finland? We think there's a huge area that's very prospective, but we recognize that we're in another country, and we need to operate respectfully for the people in that area, not only, you know, in the whole of Finland, but in the local communities where we operate. So just like Greg said, you know, our exploration geologists that are on the ground are very much our ambassadors, but we make sure that the people in the local community have a direct line of communication back to me, back to our management team, if there's concerns that they're raised, and we go out there and we sit down and spend time with them trying to address them. And we've had, through that approach, we've had some really good success, you know, with the local reindeer herders, for example, who are the main land users in the area that we're operating. You know, it's important that they understand what we're all about and we understand how their business works, because they're trying to do the same thing. They're operating a business, and we need to understand how that works and how can we help them. You know, I come from Australia where, you know, mining companies, that's what they do. You know, it's how it's always been operating with local Indigenous communities in Australia as well. And it's not always well understood in other parts of the world. So I think that was important that we applied that too.
Right. And Darren, you're in Africa, right? I think people's perception of Africa is that it's extremely difficult to do business there for some bizarre reasons that people attribute it to, or it's super simple because they don't really care. I mean, in terms of that ESG element, what's the reality on the ground in terms of the cost of doing business in Namibia, say?
Well, in the specific case of Namibia, it is a fantastic jurisdiction, as I mentioned, to work in before. They know mining. They welcome mining. And it's a very large, sparsely populated country with great endowment of minerals and metals, first of all. But it also has a fairly poor population that wants jobs and wants development in the country. So as I mentioned, we didn't view engagement with the community as an extra cost, but a required part of your business. And that's the way we've approached it from the beginning.
Right. Okay. One question. So I think, again, we're in agreement on that. With regards to nickel, and Greg, I'm going to pop back to you here. We did a sort of 2-day nickel show last year. We talked about recycling as a potential impact into the space, and you know, I think the denouement was the fact that perhaps we need all the nickel mines that we can possibly get online as soon as possible. But is there a kind of role for nickel recycling? I think it's they're achieving 70% levels of recycling at the moment. Were you not really focused on that? Not really worried about that?
No, I absolutely personally believe that we should be doing a lot more recycling than we are. But already in the stainless steel business, where a lot of nickel is consumed, a lot of stainless scrap is recycled. it's probably 30% of the nickel used in stainless comes from stainless steel scrap already. So that's great. If we transitioning to dominantly electric vehicles, there's going to be a lot of batteries that are going to need recycling. And I'm sure that's going to be a big business in the future. And as well, it should be. I definitely see recycling coming. But it's interesting, one of our senators, Senator Murkowski, who's been pounding the table for well over a decade on critical metals now for the United States and a great champion for Alaska, and Alaska as a reservoir for critical metals for the whole country. So he said, you know, she quipped one day, you have to cycle it before you can recycle it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. That's the point. And I think, to jump in there, it's very similar in Europe. Obviously, there's a very much a focus on the circular economy, producing the raw materials first, but then being able to recycle them, and the battery passport as part of that within the EU requiring, the understanding exactly the traceability and the provenance of the materials in the first place, but then being able to recycle them at the end of life. But it's so important that you obviously can't recycle what hasn't been mined in the first place. So it's very difficult. You've got to focus on getting that raw materials out of the ground first. But this is where the argument comes down to what the battery chemistries are as well. You know, certain battery chemistries are more amenable to being recycled than others. Certainly high nickel content battery chemistries are going to be more able to be recycled.
Todd, you mentioned traceability at one point early on. And, I think that's going to be coming around. I'm already seeing more and more talk of different pricing for clean versus dirty nickel. It would be nice to be able to trace it, because once, a so-called dirty nickel is into the system, it's going to be pretty hard to track it around through the recycling processes and whatnot. But, we've got to do something. There's got to be the recognition that a massive amount of coal being burned in Indonesia to smelt and further refine laterite nickel, it's completely counterproductive to the idea of Americans and Europeans and people all over the world driving electric vehicles, because the carbon footprint of that Indonesia nickel mining is so huge.
Hopefully tax incentives or premiums on nickel for the clean nickel, green nickel, will be coming. I think the Canadian government seemed quite keen to incentivize some net zero initiatives for sure. I think you mentioned Canada nickel, perhaps being a potential beneficiary of some of that, Greg. So just recycling up to on the rare earth component, most rare earth companies that we've spoken to, and I think we funded one to the tune of $100 million back in 2011 was Great Western Minerals. They like this integrated model. So recycling is part of it. There's an Aussie company as well which likes that. Darren, how do you view what you're going to be able to do without looking at an integrated model? And when would you do that if you did?
I'm looking at focusing on mining. That's who we are. That's where our lane is. I think if you're trying to do everything, you run the risk of not doing anything very well. I kind of liken it to a gold explorer trying to be a gold miner and a smelter and a producer of jewelry. It's tough to do all of that. For Namibia Critical Metals, we're staying in our lane and executing, getting this into production and mine and actually mine. There's no question that there needs to be an expanded role in both refining and separating rare earth oxides outside of China. China has 85% of the refining capacity of rare earths right now. That has to change. I don't think Namibia Critical Metals was going to be in that space.
Right. Okay. In terms of, right, so like I said, I think we've kind of discussed a lot of areas where there's a huge commonalities in terms of your thematics and perhaps the way that you're coming at the market, the way you view the market, and perhaps the way that investors should view you guys as a result. I'm going to let each of you kind of finish off here, and I might start with you, Craig, as to reasons why investors, as the new boy on the block, as it were, reasons why investors should be looking at your project, and you know why you're going to win.
I was very interested when I started this company a year ago. And the main reason I did was that I saw Canada Nickel with a large bulk tonnage nickel deposit getting a lot of traction in the market. There were $300-400 million market cap. And it happened that I knew where another very similar deposit was right here in Alaska. I had worked on it as a young man when I was working for Inco, the largest nickel mining company in the world, way back in the 90s. And so we first discovered this disseminated nickel mineralization, and there was no resource. But over the last year, we've been able to create a very large resource that contains 8 billion pounds of nickel in the ground. So I've already established a very large resource, but it's interesting to look at bulk tonnage. You know, there's still naysayers, people who say, oh, these bulk tonnage nickel mines are not going to work economically. But I think there was probably a lot of naysayers when our industry started mining copper porphyry deposits 50, 60 years ago. We migrated as an industry from mining high-grade copper veins and volcanic deposits to primarily porphyry copper deposits. And essentially, this is what I have. It's a very large volume of rock with disseminated nickel mineralization throughout this very large volume that on an economy of scale should be highly profitable. So investors in our company have the opportunity to buy at a low price, contrarian move, because nickel prices are down. But know that we will be able to expand this deposit significantly and probably increase its grade by chasing the high-grade core that exists within the deposit. So it's on American soil, near infrastructure, and could produce the critical metals that our country needs.
Todd?
Yeah, the European version. You know, we're strategically focused on Europe. You know, there's 40% of the gigafactories that are being built in Europe all happening in the Nordic region. So all around us, we're focused on the Central Lapland Greenstone Belt, Northern Finland. We already have, as I said before, a large resource that contains 862,000 tons of nickel disseminated also, but lots of potential for high-grade massive sulfides. We've only started to scratch the surface. You know, that resource is on 5 square kilometers, about 240 square kilometer land package. We're only a new company, 2 years old. We attracted the attention of BHP within the first 5 months of listing the company, and we were put onto the BHP Explore program. They gave us a grant for $500,000 US, and we're in discussions with them about an earn-in over the rest of the belt. So that gave us a massive confidence boost, but we also think that's a big upside for investors as well, to be able to position ourselves strategically for the wave of demand that's coming for critical minerals, nickel in particular, what we're focused on, but we also have potential for copper and PGEs in our projects. And as I said, there's only two nickel mines operating in the whole of Europe. They're both in Finland. One's about 100 kilometers away, the other one's 250 kilometers away on the other side of Finland. We've got the full value chain there. We've got the smelters. We've got the refineries. We're ready to go. We just need to really try and advance it with the exploration.
It's interesting to me, Todd, that that you know, you've got these gigafactories being built, these battery plants, but they've gone ahead and spent billions and billions without knowing for sure that they've got the raw materials to actually manufacture the products.
That's for me was the big disconnect as well. Absolutely, Greg. And no one really joined the dots. So let's start looking at that and focusing on how we can bring some material into the projects.
Namibia Critical Metals, we are a very advanced rare earth project. Just a few days ago, announced an updated mineral resource estimate.
which in my opinion clearly establishes Loftel as a globally significant deposit of the heavies, dysprosium and terbium. We're fully permitted with a 25-year mining license, and we have one of the best strategic partners in the world, which is essentially the Japanese government, to fully fund us through to production. And we are critically undervalued at the moment.
Very good. I like it. Gentlemen, like, I appreciate your time today. I think anyone watching this, hopefully got a little bit more on the thematic of rare earths and nickel on both sides of the pond. And more importantly, to the sorts of challenges that these guys look at each day when they're developing and growing their companies. Good teams here. Have a look. Any questions, send them through to me and I'll get them onto the guys afterwards. Appreciate your time, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.